This week, our castaway is one-sixth of the Monty Python lot, one of the less tall ones. He's a scriptwriter, a film director, a lyricist, a medievalist, a fish impersonator. It's Terry Jones. Terry, have you ever experienced loneliness in your life?
Well, I think as a child, although I wasn't lonely, I sort of had a very good family life, really. I found isolation was something that I sought. I would sort of go away and hide upstairs and write poems.
Were you an only child?
No, I had a brother. I've got a brother.
Older or younger?
He's older than me, yes. Mm-hmm. But I found that I was very much always trying to be on my own, usually actually sitting in the garage when it was raining. That was a very important time. Or just finding some small place in the house where I could get away from the television set or whatever else was going on.
Yes.
And sort of scribble little verses onto paper.
You have a miserable allowance of just 8 records. Would that help on a desert island?
Well, it's difficult to say. You know, sitting here in the comfort of Lagham Place, I'm not sure, but it probably would. I think anything would help.
Have you any musical skill yourself? Do you play an instrument?
Well, I have a guitar, but I never really learnt to play it. You know what I mean? Like, you've got to that level of skill where you know that you're not really playing it.
You have the chords.
That's right, yes. And people say, oh, that's jolly good. Play something else. And you know you can't.
Right, now, out of your 8 records, what's the first one?
Well, the first record I've chosen is really the first record I ever remember actually seeing or hearing or feeling. And it's an old 78. My brother bought it when he must have been 5 and I must have been 3. And we were living in Colwyn Bay. Mm-hmm. And so this was not 1945, I guess. And this record is by a chap called Tony Pastor. And it's called 5 Salted Peanuts. And to me, it's sort of recaptures those sort of days just after the war, I guess, and it's sort of, it's very much GI music, and it's just got an atmosphere that says Colwyn Bay to me, although it won't say it to anyone else.
I put a penny in the slot, but all I ever got was 5 salted peanuts. I always hoped to get a lot, but all I ever got was 5 salted peanuts. I'll keep trying, come what may. Maybe there will come a day I'll find a machine they forgot to fix. Instead of 5, I'll get 6. I put a penny in the slot, but all I ever got was 5 salted peanuts. I put all my pennies in, but I don't ever win. It's driving me nuts. Those darn machines know how to count. I always get the same amount. I put a penny in the slot, but all I ever got was 5 salted peanuts.
Five salted peanuts.
That's
a lot of impact, isn't it? Tony Pastor and his orchestra. Right, now, Terry, you belong to the great Welsh family Jones. Colwyn Bay, where there used to be a very good repertory company. I don't know if there still is. Where next? Did you stay in Colwyn Bay for long?
No, to my great regret as a child. We moved when I was about 4.5 or 5 years old. We moved down to Claygate, which is near Esher in the home counties,
yes.
Sort of Stockbroker belt. And I spent the next 15, 20 years of my life sort of resolutely saying, I'm not English, I'm Welsh, you know, take me back to my home, please, everybody.
Have you got the language?
No, unfortunately not. I mean, this awful thing, you see, I'm just saddled with this terrible home counties accent, and here I am feeling Celtic and wanting to be Welsh, and saddled with it.
You're beginning to sound very Welsh. You went to Guildford Royal Grammar School. Was there a kind of Welsh colony there?
Not that I ever discovered. They may have been under one of the floorboards somewhere, but I never actually managed to unloose them.
What were you best at? You must have been a scrum half.
Actually, I was a wing forward.
Uh-huh.
Maybe I should have been a scrum half.
Yes.
I played wing forward most of the time.
What did you want to be as a boy?
Well, ever since I could write, really, I was going to be a poet, I guess. I was always writing poems and scribbling verses onto bits of paper.
Were you encouraged? Was there somebody who saw the spark in your eye?
I don't know, actually. I remember at primary school, people coming along and saying, oh, isn't it wonderful, you know, he's using self-expression. It's so good to see this. And I wasn't doing self-expression. I was writing poems about cowboys and trains going through tunnels and everything. And to me, it was just sort of making things, like making chairs. It wasn't self-expression. But I suppose I must have been encouraged, although I can't really remember it now.
Did music come into your life at that time?
Only in the form of Tony Pastor and his orchestra.
Yes, yes, we've done that.
Which it was going to be my second record, but you said I couldn't have the same record twice. So
No, because you can play it as often as you like.
Oh, right.
Let's have a completely different record as your second.
Well, I thought if I'd sort of landed in this desert island, it's probably pretty traumatic, I should imagine, me.
I should think.
And I thought I'd need a piece of music that would kind of reassure me about the world and that things were going to be all right. So I chose Five Salted Peanuts by Tony Pastor, but I know we can't have that one again. So instead, I've substituted Mozart's Serenade for 13 Wind Instruments, particularly the third movement, which I don't know any piece of music that speaks more to my soul than this piece of music. It just makes me cry.
The third movement of the Mozart Serenade No. 10 in B-flat for 13 wind instruments, the London Wind Quintet and Ensemble, conducted by Otto Klemperer. Now, from Guildford, you went up to Oxford to Sir Edmund Hall. What did you read?
I read English. It's the nearest thing to not reading anything, really.
And what were your other activities?
Well, when I was there, I designed ISIS, which was the magazine of the university. Yes. But basically, I got into acting and into the theatre side of it.
And what entertainments did you take part in?
Well, we put on reviews, basically, in Edinburgh. The Experimental Theatre Club would go up with a play every year and a review, and I eventually ended up in the reviews. Mm-hmm. So I started actually acting in Turgenev was the first thing, and Brecht, I think, was one.
Yes. Well, the Oxford University Experimental Theatre Group came into the West End I'm sure you remember, in a piece called Hang Down Your Head and Die.
Oh, that's right, yes.
You were the one who died.
That's right, yes. A bit unfair, I thought.
But the production didn't.
Now, the production went off about 6 weeks, actually, at the Comedy Theatre.
Mm-hmm.
It was in the vacation before my finals, in fact. So I was sort of sitting, studying in a bedsitter in Earl's Court, and then performing in the evenings.
You then appeared in a review, the title of which was 4 asterisks... within quotation marks.
Actually, that was the year before.
The year before? Yeah, I'm sorry, I've got my thing.
That's why I know.
So you'd moved from 4 asterisks up to more serious drama.
Yes, well, you see, having done 4 asterisks at the Phoenix Theatre for 2 weeks, I mean, it was an absolute disaster, I may say. That was at the same time that Cambridge Circus were doing their review with John Cleese and Kev.
Yes.
So that was the first time I saw John Cleese.
Did you meet at that time?
I think we did, actually. I think John took me out for steak and tried to con some material out of me, one of our...
Did you write some of the material?
Well, I wrote a little bit of the material, yes, in the 4 asterisks, which we called...
That's very tactful.
Yes.
What did other people call it?
Not too good, they said.
At this time, were you resolved to make a living in the entertainment business?
It happened kind of by default more than anything. Having always decided I was going to be a poet, or I have to say an actor...
It's not the same thing.
It's not, is it? No, I know. I saw Danny Casey when I was quite young, and I thought, well, anybody can do that. And thought, that's the life for me. But it was poetry I was interested in. But I saw the economic disadvantages of this course.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, I'd become an academic. But sort of 3 years at Oxford slightly cured me of that. It was actually sitting in the Bodleian Library, reading what somebody had written about, what somebody else had written about, what somebody else had written about, what Milton had written. And I looked around all these other people who were reading what somebody else had written about, what somebody else had written about, what somebody else had written about, what Milton or somebody else had written.
And it seemed remote.
It seemed like I would rather be writing the thing in the first place.
Mm.
And then after the Edinburgh Review that year, when I came down, we were offered to do a run at the Establishment Club in London. And it seemed like kind of a natural progression, so I kind of fell into it.
Well, that's a watershed in your life, so let's have record number 3.
Well, I'm very fond of stories, Roy. I do like a good story, and I thought I ought to have one. And so this is by Dr. Hook, and it's written by one of the best songwriters alive, a chap called Shel Silverstein, and it's the story of the wonderful soup stone.
I swear you could taste the chicken and tomatoes and the noodles and the marrow bone. But it really wasn't nothing but some water and potatoes and the wonderful, wonderful soup stone.
Hanging from a string in my mama's kitchen, back in the hard time days, was a little old stone about the size of an apple. It was smooth and worn and gray. There wasn't much food in my mama's kitchen, so whenever things got tight, mama'd boil up some water, put in the stone and say, let's have some soup tonight.
And I swear you could taste the chicken and tomatoes and the noodles and the marrow bone. But it really wasn't nothing but some water and potatoes and the wonderful, wonderful soup stone.
It had been in the family for a whole lot of years, so we knew it was a nourishing thing. And I remember Mama as she stirred it in the water, and we could all hear her sing. It's a magical song. And as long as we got it, we'll never have a hungry night.
Just add a little love to the wonderful soup stone, and everything will be alright. And I swear you could taste the chicken and tomatoes, and the noodles and the marrow bone. But it really wasn't nothing but some water and potatoes and the wonderful, wonderful soup stone.
So it carried us all through the
the darkening days till finally the sunshine came. And the soupstone started into gathering dust, but it hung there just the same. And ever since then, the food's been plenty, but every now and then I find that mama in the kitchen with the wonderful soupstone drips across my mind. And again I can taste the chicken and tomatoes and the noodles and the marrow bone. But it really wasn't nothing but some water and potatoes and the wonderful, wonderful soupstone. And again I can taste the chicken and tomatoes and the noodles and the marrow bone. But it really wasn't nothing but some water and potatoes and the wonderful, wonderful soupstone.
The Story of the Wonderful Soupstone by Dr. Hook. Terry, like so many clean-living young Britons, when you came down from Oxford, you decided to join the BBC.
That's putting it strongly, actually, Roy. I tried to join the BBC when I was at Oxford, but didn't have much luck. I then spent a year writing a thing called The Sex Show, I think it's called. Oh, no, it's called The Love Show. It was about sex, that's why.
Did that go on anywhere?
No, it didn't, no.
Even with asterisks?
No, not at all. It was overtaken by the sexual revolution, really.
Mm-hmm.
And then after about a year, I decided I really ought to get a job. And strangely enough, Frank Muir suddenly offered me a job as a script editor with the BBC TV.
What sort of shows?
Well, I don't know. See, I went along to see Frank, and he said, well, you know, would you like to come and work here? You could have an office. And so I had an office and two desks and two typewriters and four telephones. And
that fountain playing in the middle.
That's right, yes, constantly going to the lavatory. And I wasn't quite sure what I was meant to be doing, except Frank had said, well, you can come around, see what's happening in the BBC, get an idea about what's going on, and write a few things, read a few scripts as they come in. And so it was wonderful. I had this sort of 6 months introduction to the BBC and how
you
it worked.
You did a little light work on Late Night Lineup, I believe.
Yes, that was later, actually. I did a director's course. Then I became a production assistant, for which I was totally unqualified, and was quite rightly given the elbow as such. And Late Night Lineup suckered me at this point and gave me a harbour as a sort of resident loony there.
Mm.
So Mike Palin and I started working together, doing a few little skits.
Now, Michael Palin, he'd been at Oxford with you, hadn't he?
Well, he was a year below me. We hadn't worked together except on Hang Down Your Head and Die.
But you'd still speak to him?
I would still, yes. Quite good friends.
And you began to write for comics?
That's right, yes, we wrote for... I think the first joke we ever wrote was for Bill Cotton, the Bill Cotton Band Show.
Yes.
And I think it was Ross Conway saying he'd just been on holiday, and Bill Cotton says, oh yes, Costa Brava, and Ross said, no, Costa Fiver. And that was the kind of response it got at the time.
Yes, I'm sorry I didn't react to that immediately. I was just thinking it out.
It was a complicated one, you know.
Very good. Do you remember any other comics you wrote for?
Well, yes. The next joke we wrote was for Ken Dodd, actually,
mm-hmm.
Which was quoted as kind of joke of the year on the newsreel roundup. Unfortunately, it's the visuals. I can't actually show it you. Well, I could show you. I will, yes. Anyway, this is okay. It was the policeman's walking race, you see. So we had all these policemen at White City all lined up, you see, yeah. On their marks. On your marks, get set, go. And then they all did the walk like that, you see.
Yes, come back.
Didn't it come over on the radio? Right?
Well, it didn't come over visually.
Well, at the time it seemed funny.
Well, despite all this, you were promoted, really, to strip editor, having sort of written for comics, which meant that having been a writer, you were now permitted to mess about the writings of other people.
Well, no, it was really the other way, actually. I moved from script editing, really, into writing. We started writing for the Frost Reports, really, in earnest. And eventually Jimmy Gilbert, who was then directing the Frost Reports, allowed us to come and take part in them as well, because we weren't making it much money. We were getting, I think it was £7 a minute for the, what we wrote.
£7 a minute?
Well, that's not a minute's worth of writing.
For a 40-hour week?
Unfortunately, no. It was a minute of what went on, you see.
So I see.
We'd spend 40 hours writing, and then if we were lucky, we'd get 2 minutes' worth on the Frost Reports, mm-hmm. which meant £7 each for Mike and me and our growing families.
Now, you decided to write for yourself. Do not adjust your set.
It was at this stage we began to feel that in writing for other people, like the two Ronnies and Marty Feldman we were writing for then...
Oh, you're dropping names now.
I am. Well, it was, you know, the jokes went down so well, I thought I'd better cover up. You know, we'd write these scripts, and they were getting on, but they weren't quite what we'd written when they were actually done.
You mean the comics were messing about with them?
Well, I tell you what happens, Roy. What happens is you go at home, you and Mike write a nice little script, you give it in to the producer, he reads it and laughs, and the comic then reads it, and then they all laugh around the script table.
Yes.
And then they start rehearsing it, and after about a 5 days rehearsal, nobody's laughing anymore. So people start inventing other things to make it funny again.
And your joke's out.
That's right, yeah. So the whole thing just suddenly evaporates.
Yes.
So we began to feel we'd like to do our own thing a bit, you know.
Well, you did that. Do not adjust your set. Then you did another series for London Weekend. You got sort of a bit huffed with the BBC.
Well, no, it was just Mike and I had got this idea for doing this history series, which was eventually called Complete and Utter History. And it was just happened that, again, Frank Muir offered us to do a series. So we grasped it with both hands.
He had moved over to London Weekend.
He had, yes.
I see.
So it was one of the very first shows that London Weekend did. It was done in black and white, can you believe?
Well, we've got you launched on your career, so let's have your fourth record.
Well, I'm going back to school time at this point. This was a record that somehow means a lot to me. I can't quite explain why. It was a record that our music master used to play as an exercise. He used to play it to the whole class, and anybody who laughed during it would be given a detention. This is a slight exaggeration, but... And so we used to sit there trying not to laugh. And eventually I bought a copy of it, and... train myself not to laugh at it, and actually I rather enjoy it now, is a strange thing, but I thought perhaps your listeners would like to listen, and if anybody can listen to it without laughing, I think perhaps we should give them a prize. There you are, Steve Roy. You were laughing at that.
I wasn't. Perfectly straight face, I promise. Duet for two violins in the sixth tone system, played by Wiesmeyer and Stein, and it was by Haber. Wasn't laughing. Perfectly straight face. Beautiful in its way. Now, with Michael Palin and four others, you were in a series called Monty Python's Flying Circus.
Yes, that came about, I suppose, in about 69. At the time... Mike and I had just done the Complete and Utter Histories, and we were recording the last series of Do Not Adjust Your Set and writing a pantomime for Watford Rep at the time. And suddenly the telephone goes, and it's John Cleese suggesting that we might like to do a show together.
Mm-hmm.
He'd been on the Frost Report, so we knew of him.
Right.
And although I'd met sort of over a steak several years before, we hadn't really known each other. But we kind of... knew that they were writing the funniest stuff around as far as we were concerned. We'd seen the 1948 shows and things like that. And so we grabbed at it and said, oh, yes, and can our friend Eric Idle and Terry Gilliam, can they come along as well?
Yes.
And that's really how the six of us got together.
Well, that's five of you. Who was the other one?
Graham yes. Chapman.
Six of you, just like the Crazy Gang.
Who
invented Monty Python?
Oh, it was a tedious business, boy. We sat around for week after week when we should have been writing scripts, trying to decide on names. We went through things like, a horse, a spoon, and a basin was one name. My favourite was...
I'm glad you didn't settle on that.
I don't think it was caught on. There was another one, the toad elevating moment was one of my favourites.
I like that.
What about owl stretching time? Any good?
No, sordid.
You can see the problem, you see.
Yes. Now, how did you sort the jobs out? Who did what?
It's basically a fairly anarchic group, really. We kind of fell into roles. I mean, as far as we've got any roles, I'm not sure that we have, except that I always made the coffee.
Who was coordinating all this? Did you have a producer or director who would say no?
Well, what happened was that when the BBC approached us about doing a show, we'd just seen the Spike Milligan show, so we said, well, we'd like Ian McNaughton to be our director.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were working with Ian, but basically it was the group, it was the six of us, sort of autonomously producing the programmes and deciding what we were going to do and then presenting Ian with the material.
Yes.
Which poor fellow, he had to sort of then get onto the screen somehow.
A lot of it pre-filmed, of course, or most of it pre-filmed.
Yes, he was quite disciplined, actually. We'd write the whole series almost before we ever started doing anything. So
the whole six of you?
Yes, the whole six.
How many programmes were in the first series?
13.
And how many series were there?
There were three series with the six of us in, and then a shorter fourth series without John Cleese.
Now, he got a bit uppity. He wanted to go off and do his own thing.
I don't think he was being uppity. I think he sort of genuinely got a bit bored with the group. See, a group is very... In a way, it's a kind of release because you can do something that is sort of bigger than any single individual in it. But at the same time, you can never follow something right the way through. It's always going to be slightly fragmented because of six people putting in. And eventually, I think, comes a point where you feel you want to go right the way through with your own thing. And I think... Mm-hmm. John felt it earlier than the rest of us.
Let's have your fifth record.
Now, I don't think I could possibly be on any desert island without the Beatles. It's difficult to choose any Beatles record more than another, but this one I remember hearing when I was driving my car across London. I suddenly heard this song, and I didn't know who it was, and it just electrified me. I just sat up and said, "Who on earth is that?" And it was only later I discovered it was the Beatles.
Penny Lane, there is a bar for showing photographs of every head who's had the pleasure to know, and all the people that come and go stop and say hello. On the corner is a banker with a motor car, the little children laughing him behind his back, and the banker never wears. Rushes in from the pouring rain.
The Beatles, Penny Lane, which of course is Liverpool, not very far from Colwyn Bay.
No, indeed.
Now, you six Monty Python people set up in business together, but you're all going to live your own lives most of the time.
Yeah, I think it's kind of the essential thing. I mean, perhaps why the group is still being able to make films together, mm-hmm. is that we've gone off our separate ways, and there's that release. So we don't feel we're dependent upon each other anymore.
No more television series, but a feature film or two.
Yeah, I think so.
The first one, Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
Well, the first one was actually called And Now for Something Completely Different, but it was a compilation, really, of the first series material that had been on TV. So, in a way, we kind of don't count that. Mm. The Holy Grail was the first one which we wrote specifically as a film and were able to direct ourselves.
Now, how did you work? I mean, six people sitting in a room arguing about a script must have taken a long, long time.
Well, it wasn't too bad with Holy Grail. We worked basically as we did with the TV shows, which is that we would go off and separate and write our own little pieces and then come back together and read out the material we'd got. And after about sort of 6 weeks of doing that, we had a certain amount of material. Then we sort of split up for another 6 months and then got together again and decided, hey, look, we could make this into a medieval thing. We could make it all about King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table. So then again, having decided on this subject, we then split up again and started writing individually. So we don't argue every line exactly. Mm-hmm. We're actually sort of coming back, reading the stuff to each other and agreeing on what we like and what we don't like.
It's pretty time-consuming.
It is, I suppose, yes. But it's the kind of essential part of it because it's the internal criticism that goes on at that stage that I think is the strength of the group in a way.
Now, your second one, which you directed, Monty Python's Life of Brian, New Testament times, a Messiah, a crucifixion, there were howls of protest.
Yes, I mean, very misguided, I think. I think most of the protest came from people who hadn't actually seen the film. And subsequent to the protest we had, various churchmen then did eventually go and see the film, and we were eventually getting very complimentary remarks from the church.
Now, why? I mean, the fact that Brian's life was remarkably similar to that of a divinity was hardly a coincidence.
Oh, no. Well, in fact, the film did start off. We were going to actually write a life of Christ. We thought, well, it'd be quite interesting to write a funny life of Christ. When we actually started working on it, which meant we went back to the Gospels and started reading them again, I think we all very quickly came to the opinion that Christ was a very good bloke, saying a lot of very good things that we all agreed with. And the humour wasn't in Christ at all. The humour was in the way in which somebody can come down, say things which are true and real, and then for the next 2,000 years, people go ahead fighting and killing each other because they can't agree on what this good person has said.
Yeah.
And that is really what the life of Brian was doing, really. Brian himself wasn't Christ in the end. He was born in the next door manger. But the parallels are there. The parody is the parody on the church. So it's heresy rather than blasphemy.
Well, that's comforting. I hope they've marked that down for you upstairs. And your third film was going to be the story of World War III, but it turned into The Meaning of Life.
Yes, well, just in case. You know, we didn't want events to overtake us and make the film obsolete, you see. The Meaning of Life, yes, I thought we thought it was time somebody tackled this subject, you know. We didn't really want to leave it for somebody like, you know, Bergman to take up or something and spoil. we thought we'd take a serious look at it.
The new film is really back to the Monty Python television series. It's a series of sketches.
Well, I think we felt we'd never succeeded in making a 90-minute film that had a shape and yet still had the freedom of the old TV shows.
Mm-hmm.
So, in fact, I think the film is very different from the TV shows, but it does have that same feeling of freedom that it can go off in any direction,
yeah.
And that it can use the animations to link it.
It does. And there's some more rough stuff, some more howls of protest, of course.
Well, I suppose there will be. When we first showed it in New York, it was actually in Yonkers, and we had an audience of about 400 high school children. And before the end of the film, 80 of them had walked out in protest and disgust and shock horror, which I was very surprised about. But I don't think there'll be any sort of organized protest in the same way there was with Brian.
Mm-hmm.
I think basically it's offending too many people for them all to get together, you know.
Yes, I think you offend everybody at one time or another.
Yes, I think so. I think to get really good organized protest, some group has to feel you're directly getting specifically at them, but everybody can see we're getting at everybody else.
Right, record number six.
Well, this is really for the artist on it. It's a violinist named Jeanette Neveu. And I came across her because it so happened my French pen friend happened to be her nephew.
What age was this?
Oh, I must have been 15 or something. And I heard the stories of Jeanette Nevers and how she died at such an early age in a plane crash and how her Stradivarius was unharmed on the seat beside her in the wreckage. And I also heard the family stories of about how she was in the conservatory with Yehudi Menuhin, and Jeanette Nevers used to come top and Yehudi second. That was the family story. And then they played me some of the records. And when I heard the records, I was just amazed by her violin playing. I'm not a connoisseur of the violin, but it seems to me when I listen to her, there's this tremendous power and kind of forcefulness, almost sort of masculinity in what she's producing. It's kind of totally unsentimental, and yet in this piece of music, it kind of conjures up to me this sort of, I don't know, the world after the war and Europe in ruins, although it was written by Brahms quite a long time before.
Thank you.
part of the first movement of the Brahms Violin Concerto, played by Ginette Neveu with the Philharmonia Orchestra. Now, as I said, between the films, Terry, you've all six been busy with your own projects. You and Michael Palin, for example, writing Ripping Yarns.
Yeah. Well, that was a kind of desire to get into story, really. I mean, Mike and I had written some stories which we'd used in Python, and I always had the feeling that Python could have gone into storylines, even in the TV series, but it never did. So when Michael was offered the chance of doing his own show, and he suggested to me that we write it together, I was very keen to get into this kind of storyline, and I love stories.
You've also achieved what most of us would like to do. You've got your own brewery.
Yes, indeed. Well, it's not my own brewery really now, but I certainly did set up a brewery in Hereford.
And it's working well?
Penrose Court. Yes, it's wonderful beer. Well, when the beer's good, it's wonderful. And when it's not, it isn't. I think the best thing about the brewery, in a way, was the fact that when I set it up, it was in 1976, kind of nobody thought about doing it for, I don't know, 100 years or so. There hadn't been anything set up much. And since we set it up, I think there's been about 60 or 70 little breweries all over the country kind of have sprung up.
And it's real ale.
Oh, it's making me
ale. No messing about.
Oh, no.
Now, you've written a book or two.
Yes, indeed, yes.
Fairy tales.
Oh, fairy tales, yes. This is a book I wrote with my daughter, Sally.
How old is Sally?
Well, she's now 9. She was 5 or 6 at the time I wrote the stories. And I just thought it would be... Well, I'd been reading Grimm's to her. I love fairy tales, again, the idea of story. And I started reading Grimm's and Andersen and found that really they were a bit too long, a bit too waffly. And to tell the truth, there were some bits of them I didn't really agree with.
Some of them are rather horrific.
Well, yes, you see, you take Snow White, for example, and you have this nice little story which you're reading to your daughter at bedtime. She's going to sleep in her nursery. And you suddenly come to the end of it, and it says in the original version that the wicked stepmother was punished by being made to put on these red-hot iron slippers and dance until she falls down dead. But I don't really like something that condones violence in that way. I think there's plenty of room for violence in stories and in comedy. And I wouldn't excise it, but I think it's the attitude to the violence which is important.
And you've written a serious piece of medieval scholarship, Chaucer's Knight.
Yes, that was something I had to get out of my system, really. It started, really, when I was at Oxford. I kind of felt that I didn't really understand 36 lines of Chaucer's poetry, his description of the knight. And I suppose while we were doing Python, I think, I started doing little work at the British Museum and sort of ferreting away, doing little research.
You decided that he wasn't a very perfect, gentle knight.
No, it took me a long time to reach that conclusion. I just felt I couldn't understand why Chaucer wrote this list of battles in which he'd been involved, when I know that elsewhere in Chaucer's work he describes very pacifist sentiments and obviously clearly dislikes war. War is something to be avoided as far as man may. And I couldn't understand why, if he thought the knight was a perfect gentle knight, he would have this list of battles spanning from that 60 years. And so I started researching into those battles. And it was the research into those that led to the conclusion that the knight was, in fact, a type of his age. He was a mercenary, which was a kind of a new style soldier in the 14th century, where there had been mercenaries before. It was an explosion of mercenary employment in the 14th century. And the mercenary armies of the 14th century, in Chaucer's day, became a horrific element in society. For instance, the great company of Holy Souls was there in the 1360s, which was the second left over from the Hundred Years' War, when he was twisting it back in the 1640s, and so on.
I think he's one of the great songwriters of our time,
Paul Simon. And this song, actually, I don't think is his best song by any means. But you know how sometimes somebody says something and it actually changes your way of thinking? I remember as a child being a slightly gloomy child very often. I mean, I loved going to the cinema, but I used to get very depressed about going to the cinema because I used to say, well, it's all going to be over in 3 hours. And then I read the cover of a book by Bertrand Russell, in which Bertrand Russell had just written on the cover of the book, I believe that happiness is nonetheless true happiness because it is transitory. And I suddenly said, oh, of course, he's right. And I became much more cheerful after that. And in this song by Paul Simon, although it's not one of his best songs, it does contain the lyrics, some lyrics that sort of change my way of looking at things. He says, some people never say the words I love you. It's not their style to be so bold. Some people never say the words I love you. Yet like a child, they're longing to be told.
They got a wall in China. It's 1,000 miles long. To keep out the foreigners, they made it strong. And I got a wall around me that you can't even see. It took a little time to get next to me. When something goes wrong, I'm the first to admit it. I'm the first to admit it. The last one to know. When something goes right, boy, it's likely to lose me. It's got to confuse me. Because it's such an unusual sight. Oh, yes, I can't get used to something so right. Something so right. Some people never say the words I speak. Something's high. Something so bold.
Thank you.
John Lennon, Imagine. If you could take only one disc, Terry, which would it be?
Oh, gosh, I didn't realise you were going to ask me that, boy. I think it would be Imagine.
Right. And one luxury to take with you, one item, one object of no practical use at all that would give you pleasure to have.
Oh, can I take a pencil and paper?
Yes, of course.
I think that's what I'd do.
And one book. You have the Authorised Bible and the Complete Works of Shakespeare provided as standard equipment. You can take one other book.
I'd take the Complete Works of Chaucer.
Right. And thank you, Terry Jones, for letting us hear your Desert Island disc.
Thank you, Roy.
Goodbye, everyone.